So I'd like to briefly introduce Ajahn Pasno. He is a co-abbot with myself at Abhayagiri Monastery. He was ordained in the early 70s, not by Ajahn Chah, but was after an initial year as a in the monastery, in what playing Vipassana in Bangkok, he moved up to the northeast and became a student of Ajahn Chah in 1973, 74. And most of his monastic life he spent in Thailand, and then took a deep breath and moved to the United States in the beginning of 1997, and we've been establishing the monastery at Abhayagiri since then. So he trained with Ajahn Chah for many years through the 70s, and then after Ajahn Chah's sickness, he was abbot of the International Forest Monastery in northeast Thailand, Wat Pa Nanachat, which was originally founded by Ajahn Sumedho. Ajahn Pasno took over after Ajahn Prabhakaro, who is Joseph Kapil now, and Jagaro, who unfortunately couldn't be here this weekend, and was abbot of Wat Pa Nanachat for 15 years before coming here.
Okay. Yes, my introduction to Ajahn Chah was through, I had ordained as a monk with very little idea what I was doing, and definitely was only going to be doing it for a short period of time. And I was at this meditation monastery outside of Bangkok, and there were several Westerners coming through there and living there and practicing, and people kept mentioning this Ajahn Chah, and who lived up in the northeast of Thailand. And actually somebody gave me a ticket to go there. Said, you should really go, and I'm sure you'll like it. And I went there after ordaining for not very long, maybe 6 weeks or something, or 2 months. And I went and paid respects to Ajahn Chah, and the first thing he said to me, and I literally almost the first thing he said to me, if you want to stay here, you have to be here for 5 years. That was not on my program. It just really wasn't there, and I struggled with that, because I really something about the monastery and the teaching and his presence and the whole sort of feeling of the place it just drew me to it, but having to actually make a commitment for 5 years. There was starting to be more Westerners coming. Actually, that first time, Ajahn Sumedho was not there. I didn't meet Ajahn Sumedho that time. And there was several other Westerners. And one of the abiding feelings that I had is, I don't want to live with Westerners. I don't want to be with them. It was quite interesting, and just wanting to be away. So I actually left after a while. Maybe I think I stayed about a month or so, and I went and practiced on my own in a meditation monastery. I had the opportunity to practice as much as I wanted. But just what kept coming up in my mind was, you have to go back and give yourself to at least 5 years with Ajahn Chah. And the teachings that I received and the example and the things that I felt really needed to be developed, I felt, I think it's Ajahn Chah really is where I have to be. So after a year of practicing on my own, I actually went back and asked to train with Ajahn Chah. So I think I was a bit more ready to be trained then. And that's really what, I mean, Ajahn Chah was a wonderful teacher, but he was, I think what more important, he was a trainer. He trained people how to live. And that, yeah, that's something different. I mean, he could expound Dhamma in just very wonderful ways and be very engaging, but what he did more was to train people. I thought, well, it was really, really quite special. And the whole way that the monastery was set up, and it wasn't just training. I think that was one of the most striking things of going to Ajahn Chah's monastery first, was the sense of not only was Ajahn Chah training monks, but he was training monks, nuns, laymen, laywomen, the sort of the whole, what is called the Buddha Parisa, the fourfold assembly. And that was very, very striking to me, how there was a way of doing things. There was a training that was going on, and there was an atmosphere for people to come into to really to practice. And one of the when I very first went to Ajahn Chah's monastery, there was the full moon in February, which is the Magha Puja festival, and it's a time when the lay people come on the observance days. The lay community and the monastic community would spend the night in listening to Dhamma and sitting meditation and up all night. And that was just astounded me. I mean, it was difficult enough for me to sit an hour of meditation. I mean, it was just pain and discomfort. And to just sit all night was, I mean, people would get up from time to time, but not much. And the lay people also were just, you know, they were sitting there, solid. And it was very inspiring to see this whole community of monastics and lay people. And then the kind of concentric rings of that Ajahn Chah influenced, you know, both the lay community that was, regulars coming to the monastery and people who would come from time to time and just come to the monastery and listen to teachings, and the community was to sort of was a bigger and sort of concentric circles around Ajahn Chah and the influence that he had. And the first time that Ajahn Chah went to, say, Ajahn Sumedho told the story of him going to England and left Ajahn Sumedho in England to establish the first monastery there. When Ajahn Chah came back to Ubon, the province and his home town for to his monastery, his home monastery, when he arrived at the train station in the morning, there was probably thousands of people at the station waiting to receive him. He'd been away for a couple months, and he was missed. People loved him. And the people were waiting at the station, and all of us, the monastery, we left Wat Pa Phong, we went to the station to meet him, and then we started walking alms round from the train station. And then people just started lining up along the roads to make offerings. And we must have walked for like through the town and then out towards the monastery, will be a couple kilometers before people started to peter out, because word started to spread. Oh, the Ajahn Chah's back in the monastery, and people were coming from all over to make offerings, and it was just extraordinarily touching, and that's the sense of say the effect, I think, that Ajahn Chah had of just, it's not, wasn't just sort of the monastic community, it was a huge effect on the lay community. And the setting that he lived in, I've been asked to sort of talk about the culture that he came from. And I think that's really one of the things, it's a tremendous sea of faith that is there, and that he created and generated, but it's also, he was supported by that. The northeast of Thailand is a very interesting area in the sense that it's very poor, they're very undeveloped, and certainly in the old, if you were a Thai person, a civil servant, and you really botched up somewhere, you'd be sent to the northeast, and that's what would happen. Yeah, as just if you got transferred to the northeast of Thailand, it was just being sent to Siberia. It was a punishment. But the materially very not well off at all. The seasons are quite extreme. When it's hot, it's extraordinarily hot. When it comes to dry season, then it's just bone dry, and the land is extraordinarily parched, and the soil is like dust. It's just nothing much there. It's really subsistence living. And then when the rains come, everything comes to life, but then usually it's usually too much, or there's a drought, or it doesn't come. So people grow up in great difficulty. But it's very interesting to note that the majority of accomplished forest masters come from the northeast of Thailand. Many of the great scholars in Thailand come from the northeast of Thailand. And there's this resilience in them that lends itself to they're not really looking for a refuge outside. And there's that culture has really informed Ajahn Chah and his training and teaching, so that difficulty was not that problematic. And he grew up with difficulty. And in order to really practice and train, he wasn't sort of afraid of difficulty. And I think it's an interesting perspective in terms of that if we're really going to practice, are we actually ready to deal with difficulty, to have the patience, as Ajahn Sumedho was speaking about. And it's really extraordinarily important. So this northeast of Thailand is a sort of there's a wealth, a spiritual wealth that's there. And oftentimes, when I was abbot of Wat Nanachan, people would come to visit, and I'd ask them, you ask them where they're from, and they're from Bangkok, or they're from the south of Thailand, and whatnot. And I'm sort of say, oh, you come from the poor parts of Thailand. I said, and they're sort of, what do you mean? Because it's usually if you come up to the northeast, it's sort of, oh, that's the northeast that's really poor. I said, well, yes, you're in the other parts of Thailand. You might have material well-being, but the spiritual wealth is really lacking, not in the same way that the Northeast culture really supports the practice of and I say also with the monastics, but also that involvement with the lay people. I can remember one time when I left, once we have 5 years of training, then we have the opportunity to go go on tudong, which is good to traveling and living and practicing in forests in different places. And it was an interesting phenomenon to be able to go to the central part of Thailand, and on the observance days, lay people usually didn't come to the monasteries in the same way that they do in the Northeast. Northeast, it's when the observance day comes, they go to the monasteries. They go to listen to teachings. So, on a certain level, it was kind of a holiday. It's like, oh, I don't have to give a talk. I can sit meditation on my own. But it was, after a while, you start to really miss that, the sense that involvement and the faith and the interest in the teachings. So that this Northeastern culture that Ajahn Chah grew up out of is a nurturing environment. There's a directness in the Northeast. Ajahn Chah was extraordinarily direct, and there's an earthiness in that culture that is Ajahn Chah embodied very much. And many of his ways of communicating sometimes was just very direct and short. Because that was how they, or this wonderful array of grunts and this sort of these wonderful grunts that had all had meaning somehow. And that was really great. It's just cutting through the, particularly for us as Westerners, because we get so verbal, and that kind of directness was very wonderful. And the ability to speak to the human condition and not cover things over with the setting that he was in, he was really able to just sort of didn't have to dance around the difficulties of life. And imagine, and people could hear it, and he would be very direct. I remember one occasion where Ajahn Chah was sitting receiving visitors, and this layperson came and was a layman, and he was obviously distraught, crying. And he'd been to the monastery before Ajahn Chah knew him, and Ajahn Chah sort of saw him, what is his state, said, okay, calm down, what's the problem? And he sort of, oh, I can't really talk, it's just really a big problem, and I can't really, he said, okay, just settle down, and he starts to talk, oh, it's just too big a problem, and he starts crying again, finally, he sort of gets himself calmed down, and I just said, okay, what is it? He said, my wife has died. Ajahn Chah, I thought you said there was a big problem. That's a little problem. Everybody dies. I thought you came to monasteries. Haven't you ever heard this before? Birth and death are very ordinary. It was just he didn't buy into the emotion, the grief, the proliferation, the feelings. He really went, what's the problem here? And that kind of directness is, it could be quite shocking, and I'm sure he was shocked. But it was a whole other way of, holding it, a whole other way of stepping out of how we create our problems and make them and you say continue to feed them, so that he really didn't give a lot of room for us to feed our problems and our neuroses and our desires and our attachments. And that was really wonderful. It's an extraordinary gift to have that directness. Because on the level of feeling, it feels like we should make a big thing out of this. But when you really cut through it, things aren't so big. So that kind of directness, using the forest as a setting. I mean, Ajahn Chah lived in forests. He was a forest monk. He used the environment to train us. And that sense of being in a place of nature was a gift for people to come into and train and to get a respite from the busyness of the world around, but also using just the simple things of nature to start to reflect on Dhamma. And he's making teachings of the things around him all the time. So that I remember one time walking back from alms round with him, and you'd walk because he's a senior monk, you'd be walking behind him and walking a little bit behind and sometimes chatting with him. Sometimes he'd be asking questions, other times just sort of walking and being behind him, and if there was something he needed me to do, fine. If not, fine, and just sort of being there. And we're walking down a path in the monastery, going back to the dining hall, and these two lizards fell out of the trees and came plop down in front of us. And they'd been mating in the tree. And he turned and said, "See that?" He said, "If they hadn't been mating," and he said, "they would have been more careful than that. They wouldn't have fallen out of that tree." He said, "I'll bet that hurt." So it's very ordinary circumstances. Just pull it around and make a teaching out of it. Point it, and the environment was one that was there for teaching. So I think it's 11 o'clock.